Part 3. The Promised Land. Chapter 26. Bratislava, July 1945. Again, the three girls squeeze into a seat made for two on the train to Bratislava. They take no notice of the countryside as it streams away. There is nothing here for them any longer. Instead, they pore over the photos in the pillowcase. "I wish we knew what happened to Uncle Ivan and the cousins," says Livy, staring at a photo of their uncle and mother as teenagers. Magda sighs and touches her sister's shoulder. "We will find out sooner or later. They might even be in Bratislava," she says. Magda watches her sisters as they reacquaint themselves with the family snapshots. They had been apart for over 2 years, and the siblings she found in Auschwitz in no way resembled those she knew in Vranov. Magda feels guilty. She can't help it. While they suffered, she slept in their bed, ate the food they should have been sharing, enjoyed the company of the mother they so desperately miss. How will she ever find her way back to them, separated as they are by their experiences? She reaches over to stroke Livy's hair, now thick and strong with the telltale reddish hues she and Sibby envy. She pulls a strand away from Livy's face, tucking it behind her ear. "Bratislava is huge, Magda." Livy throws a photo onto the pile. "How would we find them? What are we going to do? Walk the streets, hoping we'll bump into them like they're our neighbours? If you've got a better idea, then please tell us," Magda fires back. She is exhausted too. But Livy is furious, not with Magda, but with those who decided putting them on another train and abandoning them to their fates is some kind of recompense. Someone is living in their house, their mama's house. Magda gathers up the pictures and thrusts them back into the pillowcase, which she clutches to her chest. Hours later, the sisters are crossing the main street of Bratislava. Several shops are open, and there is an air of business as usual in the bustling city. It is late afternoon, and their feet ache from pounding the pavement, hoping to spot at least one friend from Auschwitz or Vranov. Livy's eye lingers on the two very thin young men approaching. "They look Jewish," Livy says, nodding at the men. "They look Jewish," mimics Magda with a grin. "How is that helpful?" "Well, they do," Livy pouts. "Aren't we looking for Jews?" "That's enough," snaps Sibby, and her sisters fall silent. Sibby steps up to the young men. "I was wondering if you could help us," she says. The men glance at each other and then at Sibby.
"Happy to, if we can," says one.
"We've just arrived in Bratislava," Sibby begins.
"Which camp?" the other asks.
"Auschwitz-Birkenau."
The men exchange another glance. "I'm Fredo, and this is my friend Imrich. We were in Auschwitz too. Where do you live?"
"Vranov. But someone has taken our house."
Sibby feels like crying, right there in the street.
This is too hard. Every word spilling from her mouth paints a picture of their never-ending despair. But Fredo is smiling, nodding his head.
"Don't worry," he says.
"We can help. There's a space in an apartment in our block where you can stay for a bit. The girls who live there are survivors too."
Sibby notes her sister's wary faces and makes the decision for them.
"Thank you. We've got a little money."
"Keep your money," Imrich says.
Sibby nods and holds out a hand. "I'm Sibby, and this is Magda and Livy. We're sisters."
As they walk, Sibby and Livy tell the men about their time in Auschwitz, about the death march and then their escape, the full horror of their ordeal spilling easily from their mouths as the boys nod and listen. Sibby feels better afterwards and decides she will talk to whoever is ready to listen. But Magda has added very little during this exchange. Learning once more of the horrors her sisters endured in her absence only compounds her guilt. They navigate their way across a bombed-out estate of houses until they reach Fredo and Imrich's apartment block.
"Who owns the building?
"And how come you can stay here?" asks Sibby, as they begin to climb the flights of stairs.
"No idea. We're squatting. But there's running water. No electricity, though. So it's a little romantic dining by candlelight."
Freddo laughs.
"We're all survivors here," says Imrich. "Some of us have already found work. We share what we make. It's a bit like a commune."
On the second floor, Imrich leads them to apartment 8. He knocks and a female voice calls out, "Come in!" The door opens onto a small lounge. Two girls around Sibby's age, who had been lounging on a mattress in the middle of the room, jump to their feet. They hug the men, and Sibby instinctively feels they can trust these young people.
"This is Clara and Branka," says Imrich to Sibby.
"The girls need a home," he tells his friends.
"Of course," says Clara, the taller of the two women. "There's plenty of room for you. A whole room, in fact, which you could share."
She turns to Branka. "We just need more bedding, don't we?"
"Clara and I sleep here," Branka points at the mattress. "And Camilla and Irena share the other bedroom. We're a cozy family."
Sibby's eyes well up. She feels for her sister's hands.
"How do we thank you?" she says.
"Don't be silly," Clara laughs, throwing her arms around Sibby.
"You've just forgotten what it feels like to have friends. We all have."
Magda and Livy watch in silence as Sibby weeps in Clara's arms, their brave older sister, undone by this simple gesture of kindness. Freddo and Imrich make their excuses and leave, and the sisters are shown to their new bedroom.
"It's perfect, isn't it, Sibby?" Magda asks.
Sibby is rubbing her eyes, but she's smiling and nodding.
"Help us with dinner," Clara calls, and once the girls have opened a window to air out the room, they join their new landlords in the tiny kitchen.
Sibby and Livy find the cutlery and an odd assortment of plates and lay the table. The sun is setting and the room dims.
"I've got some candles in a drawer. I'll get them," says Branka.
"Magda, can you find something to put them in? We don't want them falling over and burning down what's left of the building."
As Branka pulls two candles from a drawer, Magda gasps.
"I've got just the thing," she says, leaping from the table.
Moments later she returns, holding the silver candlesticks, now liberated from the pillowcase.
"Will these do?" she asks.
"They're perfect. Where did you get them?"
Branka asks delightedly.
"They're all we have left of our mother,"
says Magda in a whisper. "Mama would love the thought of them at our first meal with new friends," Sibby says, her voice dropping to a whisper too.
"I'll light them," pipes up Livy, taking the candlesticks from Magda. "Sibby's right. Tonight we eat by the light of Mama's watchful eyes."
Later that evening, after a meal prepared with the apartment's final two residents, Camilla and Irena, the women retreat to the large flat on the top floor, which has access to the rooftop. Survivors from other apartments gather to share their stories of life in the camps and life after. The sisters learn that every day the men and women go out looking for work. Some are lucky, and those who aren't are tasked with making their living conditions more comfortable by scouting the other flats for food, furniture and toiletries.
"Tomorrow you must visit the Red Cross offices," Branka tells the sisters. "They'll register your return and help you find family and friends."
"Someone will help us. Actually, help us find our uncle."
Livy's voice is shrill, and the rooftop falls silent. Branka reaches for her hand.
"I hope so, little Livy," she says softly. "I really hope so."
The evening draws to a close, and people begin to shuffle to their feet and head for their beds. Sibby is aware that several young men and women linger to finish their conversations, their heads bent close as they talk. Normal life might be possible after all, ponders Sibby. She remembers Yoshi, the cheeky boy from the Khashara, who so loved to throw his bread at her head. Maybe one day she too might find someone to love. The sisters' lives fall into a pleasant rhythm, each of them happy to lose themselves in a new, independent routine. Sibby is the luckiest, finding short spells of office work where she uses her typing skills. Livy and Magda find themselves office work too, filing paperwork and helping tally the accounts of small businesses, or cleaning. When they're not working, they fix up the apartment. Sibby and Livy had spent enough time watching the Russians construct Birkenau, so it's no surprise that they prove to be dab hands at mixing cement and fixing broken bricks back into the walls of their flat to afford them some protection over the winter months. "You girls sure know your way around construction," Freddo says, watching in awe as Sibby and Livy slap the bricks with mortar. As the weeks pass, the sisters feel like they're waking up from a bad dream. Each night, before they go to bed, the girls look through the photos, their hearts aching as they relive their happy childhoods before it all went so wrong. But it's no longer unbearable to face these memories. Livy cries herself to sleep every night, the pain of losing their home in Vranov still so fresh in her mind. Her dreams are confused things. The thug at their house shoving them into the street, into the arms of an SS officer who orders them onto a cattle wagon, which is laden with actual cows. But each morning she wakes up and decides life must go on, and slowly she begins to feel stronger. Sibby visits the Red Cross at least once a week, scanning the lists for her uncle and aunt's names, but so far she has had no luck. One afternoon, 2 months into their residence in Bratislava, she returns home to find a man lurking outside the door of their apartment. Friend or foe? She wonders instinctively. But Sibby reminds herself she is safe here, that a single cry for help would bring people from every apartment running to her aid. "Can I help you?" The man turns round slowly. He is clutching his hat in his hands, twisting it round and round with thin fingers. "I'm looking for..." he begins. Sibby gasps, reaches for the wall for support.
"Uncle Ivan?" she whispers.
"Sibby!" he cries. In seconds they are hugging, each of them sobbing onto the shoulder of the other. Sibby recognizes him by the glint in his eyes, the shape of his nose, but everything else about her uncle is different. His once proud posture is stooped, his black hair is now white and straggly. Lines etch his features, but his smile is as wide and warm as it had ever been. "Magda? Livy?" he says hesitantly. "They're fine. We're all fine. And Aunt Helena? The children?" It's Sibby's turn to sound hesitant. Ivan looks at his misshapen hat. "The children have been through a lot. It will take some time for them to adjust."
"Aunt Helena?"
Ivan hangs his head as the tears begin to spill down his cheeks. "We lost her, Sibby. She's gone," he croaks. "She fell on the death march." He doesn't need to say any more, and Sibby doesn't press him. Once more they're crying in each other's arms. "I want to see Magda and Livy," Ivan says, finally. Sibby nods, takes his hand, and leads him into the apartment. The next day, the family gathers at their uncle's apartment block, mere minutes from their own. The sisters listen as their cousins recount the moment their mother fell and was then shot by an SS officer. It is painful to hear, but Sibby knows now that talking about it will help them, however distressing the memories. "There is an empty apartment above," Ivan tells the sisters. "It would make me very happy if you girls moved in. We could be a family again." The sisters don't even need to discuss it. That same afternoon, they say goodbye to Branka and all their friends, with promises to stay in touch, and move their meagre possessions into Ivan's block. they celebrate the first night of their reunion with their uncle, drawing up chairs and crates to sit round a small table and eat. When the table is set, and the food steaming in mismatching bowls, Magda reaches for her bag and pulls out the candlesticks, replete with the long tapers given to her by Branka. Livy strikes a match, and the room glows in the yellow, flickering light. "Are these?" Ivan begins, but can't continue, because he has started to cry. The children circle their father, patting his back, wiping away his tears. "It's okay, Daddy," they say over and over. Slowly, Ivan sits up, arms around his children. "Where, how did you get them?" he says. "I hid them in the ceiling of our house, Uncle," says Magda, "before we left, and then I went back for them." "There are photos," Sibby says. "Magda hid those, too." While the rest of them eat, Ivan doesn't put a single morsel into his mouth. He is lost in the memories stirred up by the black-and-white photographs. Gradually, the solemn mood shifts into something lighter as the children become enamoured of these images of their father as a young man.
"Daddy, you were a boy once. Auntie Chaya is so pretty."
By candlelight, they all begin to recall episodes from the lives of the brother and sister, their spouses and grandfather. Ivan rubs away the melted wax from the silver surface of the candlesticks. "I feel Chaya is with us," he says. "Looking at these photos in this special light, we have remembered the past without grief. And if we can do that, we can also look ahead without fear." Sibby recognizes the move to their uncle's block as a new chapter in their lives. While work is still irregular and poorly paid, and the daily and not-so-subtle anti-Jewish sentiment that seems to be embedded in Bratislavan society is increasingly grating, the sisters are thankful to be with family once more. Slowly, they begin to build a life together in Bratislava. Nor was Sibby misguided in her musings about romance that day on the rooftop. Mishka, a friend from the old apartment, is very keen to remain in touch, and Sibby finds herself looking forward to his visits, despite the fact that Magda and Livy waste no opportunity in making fun of their big sister.
"Oh, Mishka, I love you,"
Livy teases in a high, squeaky voice.
"You are so handsome, Mishka, so strong," Magda moans. "Sibby, marry him quickly, or one of us will."
"Yuck," laughed Livy. "That would be like marrying your brother."
But the teasing stops when, one evening, Sibby breaks the news. Uncle Ivan, her cousins and sisters are gathered together in her uncle's apartment, playing a game of charades. Sibby stands up, sits down, stands up, and begins to pace.
"What is wrong with you?" asks Livy. "You're ruining the game."
"I have something to tell you," says Sibby, sitting down once more.
"Well, tell us then," says Magda,
when Sibby says nothing.
"Okay, okay, give me a second."
Sibby is flushed, happy, grinning stupidly. "Mishka has asked me to marry him." The sisters stare at Sibby in silence, waiting for more. Ivan leaves his chair to sit beside his niece.
"And?" he asks.
"I've said yes."
The room erupts. Both Livy and Magda burst into tears. Ivan is holding Sibby tight, telling her Chaya would be so proud, that Mishka is exactly who she would have chosen for her eldest daughter. When the noise abates, Ivan is still holding Sibby's hands.
"I have an announcement too," he says, blushing.
"Uncle," yells Livy, "you're getting married too."
"I am. Her name is Irinka. She is also a survivor."
A few weeks later, in April 1946, Sibby marries Mishka. She couldn't have cared less it is on Hitler's birthday. Sibby was glad, in fact. She wished every Jew could find something to celebrate on this day, to show this man and his army of murderers that hope flourishes in the darkest of places. The couple move into another apartment in their uncle's block, ready to begin their lives together. Not long after the wedding, Sibby and her sisters are having coffee and cake in their favourite cafe, a routine that hasn't ceased despite her newly married status. The groaning hunger that defines so much of their experience in the camps is now part of their DNA. They will never forget their desperation to put something, anything, in their stomachs. These days they savour every mouthful, but more than that, they cherish the freedom to move around the city as they choose, no longer under the watchful and penetrating gaze of a capo, or worse, an SS officer. "The other day," Livy tells her sisters, biting into flaky pastry and moaning with pleasure, "I stood in front of Madame Cleo's boutique. You know the one?" The girls nod. "Just because I could. No one was going to tell me to go and clean the toilets or dig holes or sort the mail of dead people. I was just free to stand there and dream myself into those dresses." "I know what you mean," says Magda, about to launch into her own stories of the incredulous wonder of being in control of her own body. But she doesn't, because she has noticed that Sibby has gone very red in the face. "Are you okay?" she asks Sibby. "You've gone all..." "I'm having a baby," Sibby blurts. The sisters slam down their coffee cups and burst into howls of excitement. "If Grandmother were here, she'd deliver the baby," says Livy finally, turning back to her pastry. "She'd put ruby earrings into her ears," says Magda, gulping down her now cold coffee. "Would she still do that if it was a boy?" Livy asks. The girls dissolve into laughter. Every day, and for the next 7 months, Magda and Livy visit Sibby. They feel the baby kick, and they marvel at the expansion of Sibby's belly. They quiz her midwife, letting it be known they will be present at the birth. Mishka, however, won't, and it's not expected of him. Magda and Livy turn up unexpectedly at Sibby's apartment one day, demanding she accompanies them on a secret mission. "I don't want to go anywhere. Look at me, I'm an elephant," she wails. "Even elephants go shopping," Livy giggles. "Come on, Jumbo, get up." "Where are we going? You wouldn't do this to me if you knew what it was like to have a giant football in your tummy." "We don't know. You're right. And that's because you, as the eldest, have taken it upon yourself to do everything first," Magda says. "But I look so bloated and puffy." "You've looked worse, trust me," Livy says, grinning. "That's not fair. You looked just as bad as me," Sibby throws back at her. "I never looked as bad as you two did I?" Magda says, suddenly serious. "But you would have, if you had been there as long as we had," Livy says, and immediately wants to bite back the words. "I'm sorry, Magda, that came out wrong. I'm an idiot." Livy hangs her head. "I know it did. It's okay. Just help me get the elephant up off the sofa, into her shoes and out of the door." Sibby lets herself be dragged out of the apartment and onto the busy high street. Livy lingers by every clothes shop they pass, and each time Magda urges her on. "This trip is for Sibby," she says impatiently, "not you. Come on, we're nearly there." Magda and Livy stop in front of a large shop, its windows full of prams and cots and tiny mannequins sporting colourful children's clothes. "We're here," Magda announces, finally. "I can't afford anything in there," Sibby says, deflated. "But we can, Sibby." Livy takes her arm to lead her into the shop, but Sibby resists. "It's okay," Livy soothes. "We've saved a little money from our wages these past few months, and now we have enough to buy a pram for that soccer ball." all you have to do is choose the one you want, Magda says. We weren't going to have a pram. We can't afford one. You are going to have a pram, Sibby Miller, Livy insists. Mama would have wanted you to have one, and we want you to have one. Will you please come inside and choose one? Magda takes Sibby's arm, and finally, Sibby allows herself to be dragged inside the shop. An hour later, Sibby is pushing a brand new pram all the way home. The sisters are quiet, aware of those who can't be here as they prepare to welcome a new generation of Mellers, but it's Sibby who looks the saddest. Are you okay? Livy asks, taking her hand. Is it the pram? Sibby seems to come back from far away. No, Livy, of course not. I love the pram. It's everything I could have wished for. Is it Mama, then? Are you thinking about her? I'm always thinking about her. But that's not it either. Sibby pushes the pram to the side of the pavement, and the sisters follow. What is it, then? Asks Magda, puzzled. It's Mishka, says Sibby. She meets her sister's eyes and looks away. This isn't his first child, she says. Livy and Magda stare at Sibby, waiting for more. I don't understand, says Magda finally. He has another child. Sibby nods. Mishka has been married before, and he has also been a father before. The truth behind Sibby's words hits Magda and Livy at the same time. They each place an arm around her shoulders and draw her close. Poor Mishka, thinks Magda. Just like us, he has lost so much. Thank you for telling us, Magda whispers, her voice breaking, her heart breaking for the brother-in-law they have come to love. Is he happy that you are having a baby? Livy asks, tentatively. Oh, Livy, yes, he is. Very happy. He calls it his second chance. Then it will be a very special baby, Magda says. Has he told you much about his first family? Before we were married, he told me everything, and we haven't spoken about it since. His child, was it a son or daughter? A daughter. Her name was Judith. Sibby falters, clears her throat. She was 3 years old when she was taken away with her mother. Livy stamps her foot, turns away, looks up at the sky. The sisters are sniffing, wiping their eyes, each of them recalling the terrifying images of the very young children being lowered into the arms of their mothers and fathers from the cattle wagons. They had been too young to know what was going to happen to them, but old enough to realize they had arrived in hell. Sibby notes the flame in Livy's eyes, the flare of her nostrils. It's all right, Livy. Honestly, he'll be fine. Mishka will hold this little baby in his arms, and he'll remember Judith and the first time he held her, and then he will love and protect his second-born child with his life. I know he will. His new son will fill the hole in Mishka's heart, Sibby, says Magda, just as you have done. Oh, Magda, when did you become so wise? And how do you know I'm having a boy? Sibby is smiling now, happy to have shared her husband's story with her sisters. I've always been wise. The two of you just never saw it. And I do believe you will give Mishka his first son. That night, Magda crawls into bed with Livy, who is sobbing into her pillow. Do you want me to give you a cuddle? She asks Livy. I can tell you've been thinking about Mama all day.
I have. And Mishka, too. His little girl.
I know, says Magda. Me too. But you cry every night, Livy. Are you dreaming about Mama?
No. I wish I did, says Livy, wiping her nose on the sleeve of her nightdress.
What do you dream about, then?
I think about Mama and our little house before I fall asleep,
And then for the rest of the night, I'm back in Birkenau. Magda wraps her arms around her sister. What could she say to this? She pulls Livy close and sings her a child's lullaby until she falls asleep. When Sibby goes into labour, her sisters are by her side, taking turns to hold her hands, bathe her with wet flannels, and encourage her with advice neither is qualified to give. A whole day and night passes like this, and still the baby hasn't arrived. When the sun begins to set on the second day, everyone is exhausted and subdued. And then, suddenly, Sibby breaks the monotony of their patience with a piercing scream.
"It's coming!" Sibby yells. "Now!"
Magda and Livy snap to attention. Livy wipes Sibby's face clean of sweat and tears. Magda, at the foot of the bed with the midwife, yells,
"Push! One more time, Sibby! Push!"
The sound of a newborn fills the room. Magda and Livy promptly burst into tears.
"Mama should be here," sobs Livy. "I can feel her here," says Sibby, tiredly touching her chest. "I really can, but I can see my sisters."
"Don't you want to know what you've got?" asks Magda, nestling a small bundle of blankets in her arms. Sibby stares at the new baby and nods.
"A boy," says Magda. "I have a boy," says Sibby softly, taking the bundle.
She looks into the wrinkled face of the newborn.
"Magda, Livy, we have a baby boy."
"Would you like me to send the father in to see his son?" asks the midwife.
"In a moment," says Sibby, gazing into the blue eyes of her son. "Just give us a few minutes. He'll understand."
Livy reaches over, gently stroking the face of her nephew. Sibby places the squirming bundle into her sister's arms, and Livy looks into his puffy little red face as she begins to sing.
"Lie, my little angel, lie and sleep. Mama is rocking her baby. Lie, sleep, sweet little one. Mama is rocking her baby. Lie, my little angel, lie and sleep. Mama is rocking her baby. Lie, sleep, sweet little one. Mama is rocking her baby."
When Mishka steps into the room, the tears flowing freely down his face, Livy takes Magda's arm, and the sisters leave husband and wife alone to welcome this precious child into their family. As the months pass, Magda and Livy watch Carol grow from a tiny baby into a big baby, but Livy also watches her big sister ease into being part of a new family. Their uncle now has Irinka, who is adored by his children. What does Livy have? She is beginning to feel restless, but Magda has no desire to shake up their lives again. It is an everyday act of racism, one of the many that have come to define the boundaries of their existence in Bratislava, which makes up Livy's mind.
"Chocolate! Can you believe it?"
Livy has just stormed into their apartment, rage painting her features.
"I've just been abused for having the gall to buy some chocolate."
"What are you talking about, Livy?" Magda asks.
"Two anti-Semitic imbeciles came into the shop as I was handing over my money, and do you know what they said?"
Livy is pacing the floor. "I have no idea, Livy. What did they say?"
"One of them looked down his nose at me, and it was a big nose, and in his stupid loud voice, so everyone in the shop could hear, he said, 'Bloody Jew, who do they think they are to eat good chocolate?'"
"What did you do?" Magda is calm. She doesn't want to inflame Livy any further.
"I put the chocolate down and left."
Livy rounds on her sister.
"I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to be somewhere where I'm not abused because I'm a Jew. Somewhere I can buy chocolate and not feel threatened.
What are you saying? Magda asks, worry creeping into her voice.
Something needs to change, and I don't think it will be in Slovakia.
Over the next few weeks, Livy talks to fellow survivors about leaving Slovakia. Now under communist rule, they receive little news about the situation in Palestine and the efforts to create a new state of Israel. When Livy shares her frustrations with her friends, a few of the boys speak up and tell her that they are leaving for Israel soon, when they have done their training with the Hashara. She imagines living a life where her hard work will be fairly rewarded, where she won't always be the last one chosen for office work because she's a Jew, where she can believe that those around her want the same things for themselves as she does. In the end, she is surprised at how easy it was to make up her mind.
I want to join them, Livy tells her sisters one evening.
She and Magda are in Mishka and Sibby's apartment. Livy is bouncing Carol on her knee.
I want to join the Hashara movement and then go to Israel. I want us all to go to Israel. That's crazy talk, Magda explodes. First of all, no one is allowed to leave this country. We're all communists now, in case you didn't know. Also, haven't you heard what the British are doing to Jews who try to make it to Israel? They're turning migrants right round and taking them straight back to refugee camps.
The three sisters flinch at the word camp.
They've even boarded the boats bound for Israel.
This is true. Britain, fearing the loss of their position as the dominant power in the Middle East, has no desire to aid the creation of a Jewish nation, which might provoke the Palestinians and thus jeopardise the British power base there.
I've done my research, Magda, thank you, says Livy, her mouth set in a straight line. That's what the training is for. Don't you think our freedom is worth fighting for? We didn't leave one prison only to find ourselves in another.
Magda is silent.
Haven't you had enough of Slovakia? Livy asks her sisters. When was the last time you got a job lasting longer than a week, Magda? And you, Sibby, do you want to bring up your baby in a country which still seems to hate its Jews?
Magda opens her mouth, but Sibby lays a hand on her sister's arm. Magda turns to her. Sibby is smiling. She's not wrong, Magda. And I was in the Hashara, remember? They will look after her.
We are not allowed to leave this country, Magda repeats. No one is. What will they do to her if they capture her?
Magda shivers.
No one will capture me, says Livy, and I won't be allowed to leave until I'm ready.
Livy is a woman now, Magda. She's 21 years old. Let's just hear her out. Magda rounds on Sibby.
Why are you keen suddenly to get rid of our sister? I thought we had a pact. I thought we were supposed to stick together, to look after each other. We promised, Father, we...
Magda, listen to me, says Sibby. You must go with Livy. Do the training and get to Israel. Sibby's voice is calm, reassuring, as if Livy's choice is the obvious one to make. And then Mishka, Carol and I will follow you. Magda's mouth falls open. We won't be joining the Hashara because of the baby, but we'll find another way.
See, Magda?
Livy is on her feet, punching the air.
Sibby is going too. It's decided.
Nothing is decided, little sister. Magda is quiet, imagining life in Bratislava on her own. It is an impossible picture. I need to think.
But you're open to the idea, Livy says hopefully.
Magda doesn't say yes or no, but gives a single nod instead. God will watch over you, Mishka says. He has been silent during this exchange, but now he comes to stand by Sibby's shoulder. It is the right thing for us, for the whole family. Livy grins and says, "See?" to Magda, who ignores her because she is busy, thinking. Chapter 27. Bratislava, October 1948. Magda and Livy watch Sibby and Mishka, baby Carol in his mother's arms, walk back to their car and drive away. Minutes before, Magda had reluctantly handed Sibby the pillowcase with the candlesticks and photos, and extracted a promise that she would soon follow them to Israel and give them back to me. Now, two sisters wait by the side of the road for the other young Jewish men and women to arrive. Jewish men and women who, like them, have decided to join the Hashara. They will be part of a cadre willing to risk everything to make a new life for themselves in Israel. It had been hard to say goodbye to Sibby. Of course it had. Magda views her older sister as an extension of her own body. To Livy, she is a mother and her saviour. But there was also an air of celebration to the farewell. It is October 1948, and Sibby's 26th birthday. Vows had been renewed. They are an invincible unit, and while two of the three sisters might soon be 3,000 kilometres away, this distance will not so much as scratch the exterior of their promise. But it is time for them to move on again, to make new lives for themselves, and thankfully, Magda had finally agreed she was ready. "Strength and hope," she told Sibby the night before their departure. "That should be enough to build a new world, shouldn't it? But we need your help to do it, so don't waste any time." The men and women arrive in their hundreds and begin to board the trucks idling by the side of the road. Livy isn't sure if she's excited or terrified as they begin to pull away. What if this is a terrible mistake, and she has dragged Magda right back into danger? The canvas flaps are drawn against the prying eyes of the Bratislavans as they move out of the city, and Livy wonders if there will ever come a time when they can freely, openly, go wherever they want. They bounce along the gravelled road, bumping over small rocks, swerving round craters, while Magda's mind drifts back to her time in captivity, when a similar truck had delivered her to a prison. She wonders what happened to Mr. Klein. But the excitement in the vehicle is infectious, and soon Magda finds herself relaxing into the company of cheerful and hopeful young men and women. It is cold, with winter just round the corner, but the sisters are snug in thick scarves, hats, warm coats and sturdy footwear. They are strong and healthy again, and now, 3 hours and 150 kilometres later, the truck stops in a plot of mud and forest vegetation. This will be their home for the next 3 months. "Breathe in the air, Magda. How wonderful it feels. It reminds me of the forest back in Vranov," Livy squeals. Magda has to agree. The smell and taste of forest air is like no other. She thinks of home, of grandfather. They are told that they have crossed into the Czech side of Czechoslovakia. They are in the woodlands of Moravian Karst, near Blanco. But this information means nothing to Livy and Magda. Their feet are cold, and they are desperate to get inside. Their accommodation consists of small huts, girls on one side, boys on the other, arranged around a large central building where they will gather for meals and lessons to prepare them for what lies ahead. After they unpack, Magda and Livy follow everyone else into the main hall. They are informed that their training will be intense and require courage. They will soon embark on a journey across a hostile European landscape, through countries now under communist rule, closed to the outside world. "You will learn to travel light, move unseen, and fight when you have to," their instructor tells them. "We are not communists, we are Jews, and we have paid dearly for the freedom to choose where we want to settle and live our lives." While they feel daunted by the idea of training, both Magda and Livy are eager to begin the journey, desperate to believe the memories which haunt them will magically disappear once they set foot in Israel. that first night, they fall asleep filled with a sense of purpose, of hope that they will acquire the tools to carve out a future for themselves, and eventually for Sibby, Mishka, and baby Carol. They triumphed when the world was against them, and have come so far. Magda is determined that the hope which kept them alive in the camps will drive their ambition to finally determine their own fate. They train in the Moravian forests, and what many lack in fitness, they make up for with enthusiasm. Magda and Livy find themselves in caves and canyons, in dense woodland and deep snow, challenging the elements as they are tasked with surviving the night in the wild with few provisions. The girls' stamina grows, and they discover their appetite for the challenge is huge, and soon they are sailing through their exercises. "We faced much worse at Auschwitz," is Livy's cheerful and constant refrain. It is when the sisters are handed revolvers that they face their first real hurdle. Neither want any part in learning how to fire a gun, and they are not alone. "The communists will not let us leave Europe," their instructor tells them, "and the British do not want us to travel to Israel. We are still being rounded up, whether on land or at sea. Who here wants to be sent to a detention camp, have their freedom ripped away? Haven't we suffered enough?" His message is clear. To move to the next level of training, they will have to learn how to use a weapon. At the shooting range the next morning, the sisters accept the guns offered to them, and Livy proves to be a skilled marksman, to Magda's astonishment. "How?" asks Magda, staring at the scattered tin cans on the ground. "If you imagine they're Nazis," says Livy cheerfully, "it's really very easy." For Livy, each tin can is the face of Isaac, with his greasy black hair and yellow teeth, every time she hits her target. Magda raises the weapon to the cans lined up on a tree stump in the distance, and while her aim is not as accurate as Livy's, she hits more cans than she misses. "You're right," Magda turns to her sister, grinning. "They're all dead." Livy's restlessness eases as the days become weeks, and she blossoms in the company of the other men and women in the camp. There are dances, indoor sports, games and meal times. For the first time in her life, Livy feels truly independent, amongst these friends who all share the same goal. She is surprised to learn that some of the group are Christians, joining the Hashara to show solidarity and support for the Jewish dream of establishing a home in the Promised Land. Romance also blossoms in the woods, and Livy is flattered when Zdenko begins to ask her for every dance. The date of their departure draws ever closer. Soon they will begin their trek into Romania, and from there to the port of Constanta. Part of their journey will involve travelling through Ukraine or Hungary, both of which have closed and heavily patrolled borders. Magda and Livy listen intently as the dangers of such an expedition are explained to them. Livy wonders if everyone feels the same as her, that this part of the journey is almost an extension of their captivity, and simultaneously the last hurdle in their bid for freedom. They walked away from the death march, didn't they? And that took so much more courage. Livy feels ready to walk away again, but she can't pretend she isn't scared. Travelling in small groups will provide some protection, but they will have to be very careful. If they make it to the port of Constanta in Romania, they will find a ship waiting to take them to Haifa. It will be leaving with or without them. On the day of departure, Magda and Livy's group of around 100 trainees travel by truck back to Bratislava. With money in their pockets, they will take trains where they can, otherwise hitch rides or walk. Each of them has a gun and a supply of bullets. Livy and Magda put the bullets in their bags, the guns they shove deep into their coat pockets. "Are you upset that Zdenko isn't in our group?" Magda asks. "A bit, but not really." "Do you like him, Livy?" "Of course I like him. No romantic feelings.
No. He's a friend, that's all.
Friendship is a good basis for something else, Magda teases.
Well, Magda, when you have found the one, you can tell me what it feels like. Then I will know what to look for. Until then, sister, mind your own business.
Are you scared, Livy? Asks Magda, suddenly solemn. Livy looks at her big sister and sees her own fear reflected in Magda's eyes.
It can't be worse than a death march, can it? Or a selection, she replies.
I guess that's one way of looking at it, Magda says.
It's the only way.
The trainees take trains to a range of different towns, from where they will position themselves to cross into Romania. Vranov was one of the options, which Magda and Livy rejected. They chose instead to travel to Kosice and make their way through Hungary. From there, they hope the locals will direct them to Constanta. They have been given maps and a guide, Vlad. With three other boys, the sisters listen while Vlad tells them they will have to cover another 500 kilometres once they are in Romania.
"Do you think we will have time to visit Father's grave in Kosice?" Livy whispers.
"I don't think so, Livy. We need to keep moving. We'll come back one day," Magda says. Livy leans back and shuts her eyes and lets the motion of the train lull her to sleep. Arriving in Kosice, the group of six are aware of their friends also disembarking the train, but they ignore one another, as they have been instructed to do. The group is now on their own.
"Only 13 days to go, and you'll be on the boat," Vlad tells them, as they walk the city streets of Kosice. "Let's find somewhere warm to spend the night."
"A hotel?"
asks Livy, hopefully.
"A barn," he replies.
"No soft blankets and feather mattresses for you, Livy," one of the boys teases.
"Will you be okay? Or should we shoot some ducks and pluck them for your pillow?"
"That would be lovely, thank you," Livy fires back. It's getting dark when they reach the outer limits of the city. They are on a deserted road, woodlands to the left and right of them, but no sign of any barns. The boys want to camp in the woods, so does Vlad, but Livy wants to hold out for shelter. All six heads turn round at the sound of the clip-clopping of a horse. Vlad's hand goes inside his jacket. Livy tenses.
This is where it falls apart, where they will be taken captive once again, punished for wanting more than a life lived in the shadows.
Magda takes a deep breath, trying to control the trembling in her hands. She'll never shoot anyone. She knows that now. Because how can she, when, at the first sign of danger, she falls apart?
"Where are you off to?"
A farmer whose cart is being drawn by a fine black mare has pulled up. Vlad withdraws his hand and waves. Both Livy and Magda exhale.
"To Trebisov," he replies. "You're Jews?" "We are."
Livy glances at Vlad, but his eyes are fixed on the farmer. If he's not worried, then neither is she.
"Hop on the back. I'll take you as far as I can."
They climb aboard. The cart reeks of animal dung, but they're comfortable enough in the straw.
"Sorry," calls the farmer. "I had pigs in the back."
They trot along in silence for about an hour. Vlad holds himself erect the entire journey. He might as well be on a train or in a car, thinks Livy, adjusting her own posture. The farmer eventually pulls up at a fork in the road.
"Trebisov is about 10 kilometres down the road. You can walk there now, or you can sleep in my barn tonight. It's up to you."
"It is getting late," Livy says, hopefully.
"Thank you," says Vlad to the farmer. "We would be grateful. I promise we'll be gone before you wake up in the morning." "I doubt that," the farmer grins. "You ever run a farm?" He winks.
With a flick of the reins, the horse continues down a narrow track to a small farmhouse, beside which looms a large barn.
"Make yourselves at home in there," he tells them. There are still a few pigs inside, but they shouldn't bother you. And my wife will bring you some food in a bit.
He offers a wave and strides off to the farmhouse. Thank you, they chorus. While they are making beds from the abundant piles of straw, the farmer's wife enters the barn.
Will someone give me a hand? She calls.
Vlad and Magda help her with the mugs of tea and a huge plate of steaming potatoes and roast pork. There are 6 forks.
This is so generous of you, Vlad says.
Leave the dishes by the door when you're finished. I'll collect them later.
The farmer's wife pauses in the doorway before she leaves. We've helped other groups, you know, just like you, and we'll do what we can for those that come after you. With that, she is gone. Still unused to the random kindness of others, Livy feels a lump in her throat.
Livy, don't look so surprised, Vlad tells her. Not everyone hates Jews.
The boys and Magda burst out laughing.
Let's eat.
They gather around the plate of food. Maybe she doesn't know that Jews don't eat pork, says one of the boys.
He did warn us he had pigs, sighs Magda. But Livy, do you remember the house with the Russians?
Livy nods.
When we have no other food, we eat pork.
The boys are still laughing when they all pick up their forks and dive in. The next morning, the farmer wakes them with tea and fresh bread. He offers to take them to Trebisov.
Day 2 of 14, Vlad announces.
In Trebisov, they buy food and head for the border. They are in Hungary. That night, they sleep in the woods. Livy would rather sleep in the open now, as far away from people as possible. While she has the skills to survive in the wilds of the countryside, her nerve for any confrontation with an enemy will fail her. She is sure. She wishes Sibby were with them. The promise that they will always be together weighs heavy in her mind. Are they tempting fate by leaving her behind? Over the next 10 days, they hitchhike, walk, and travel by train until they arrive in Constanta, 2 days ahead of schedule. They have met little resistance, and both Livy and Magda are wildly grateful. They have been lucky. They acknowledge this to one another, and pray this luck holds out for the voyage. At the port, the ship is already docked, awaiting its cargo of excited migrants. The evidence of a war recently fought surrounds them. Many buildings sit in heaps of rubble, still waiting to be cleared. But in town, the ancient buildings still stand tall and proud, untouched by the chaos that rained down on the port. A day later, the 100 trainees from the Moravian Karst forest camp, the first to arrive, are joined by hundreds more from other camps across Europe. Magda and Livy feel a thrill of exhilaration as they mill around the port, caught up in the anticipation and excitement for the journey ahead.
Everybody on board, and be quick about it!
Vlad is rounding up the young men and women, urging them towards the ship. Magda takes Livy's hand at the foot of the gangplank.
This is it, little sister, she says.
Her eyes are shining. Livy knows Magda's tears are for Mama, for their grandfather, but they are also for herself and Livy too. They are not only about to embark on a voyage across the ocean, but they are crossing over from one life into another.
I'm ready, says Livy. Let's walk up together.
Livy thinks of the three sisters on the platform of the train station in Bratislava, on their way back to Vranov. They had been so scared they had clung to each other the whole way. She doesn't feel like that now. She isn't scared, and she is glad Magda is beside her. But then Livy feels a familiar tingle up her spine, a note of dread. Again she wishes Sibby were with them, the constant protector who kept her alive in Auschwitz through sheer will and determination. Not now, she tells herself. But how do you embrace the future with an open heart when that same heart has been broken over and over again, the shards of it hammered into dust? Maybe that's what this is all about, Livy thinks, as the ship pulls away, putting our hearts back together. Sibby is safe with Mishka and Carol, and soon they will honour the promise and follow them to the promised land. Hundreds of young men and women line the decks, hanging over the sides to watch the waves roll away. Livy puts a hand in her pocket and feels the gun. Her fingers move past the weapon to find the tiny knife, her talisman. It's as much a part of their struggle to survive as their mother's spiritual presence. Magda, she says quietly, I'm going to chuck my gun into the sea. It doesn't belong with the knife. While they could both kill, the knife has only ever come to her aid. What? Don't be stupid, Livy. Someone will see. They're not looking at me. You can't know that for sure. Please, leave it alone. And before Livy can take the gun out of her pocket to launch it into the waves, they are joined by a couple of the girls they had trained with. Did you hear? Says one, breathlessly. Magda, instantly on the alert, stares into the vast expanse of empty sea, the port in the distance growing smaller and smaller, and then into the clear skies. No communists or British ships in sight. So far, so safe. There's not enough bunks below for all the passengers, so they're looking for girls to sleep on deck with the boys. Magda can tell from the glow in their eyes, the pink of their cheeks, that they're excited, thrilled by their daring. We're going to say yes. Do you want to join us? Magda allows herself to feel the same thrill. Sure, she says. Why not? Livy? I signed up for adventure, says Livy, taking her hand out of her pocket. Of course I'll sleep on deck. We'll be in Israel in less than a week, says Magda, staring at the unending sea ahead of them. I think 5 nights under the stars is a great way to prepare ourselves. Let's go and find the perfect spot, urges Livy. Well, that will be wherever the boys are, right? Says the breathless girl. I was thinking as far away from the engine as possible, if we're to get any sleep, says Magda sensibly. Who wants to sleep? Asks the girl. I don't think I will ever sleep again. Livy takes Magda's hand as the girls lead the way to their new sleeping quarters. Please tell me you're excited, Magda, says Livy. I am. I really am. But I'm scared too, Livy. I really hope we make it without any trouble. But I guess, Magda pats her pocket, we have these guns. The girls duck under a rope, and Magda follows, unaware that Livy is hanging back. When she realizes her sister is no longer by her side, she turns round to see Livy facing a man with greasy black hair. He's older than the sisters, and there is something wrong with the expression on his face. He's sneering, not smiling. Livy and the man don't move. They look like statues. Livy! Shouts Magda. Come on! What are you waiting for? Magda starts forward, ducking back under the rope until she's standing beside her sister.
Well, well, says the man to Livy. Who do we have here?
Stay away from me. Livy's voice is trembling. Livy, what's going on? Who is this man? Magda takes her sister's arm to pull her away, but Livy doesn't move.
Going to the promised land, are you? He hisses.
Magda shivers as she sees his mouth open in a leer to reveal chipped yellow teeth. He takes a step towards the sisters. Magda's hand goes to her pocket. The man catches the movement and steps back.
I never thought you'd make it, Isaac says.
Same, snaps Livy, emboldened a little by Magda's presence. You should have been shot along with the Nazis for what you did. Magda, her hands still in her pocket, positions herself in front of Livy, blocking her view of the man. Livy, who is he? She says over her shoulder. but Livy leans past her and spits into the man's face. "You're going to be a problem for me," he asks, dragging a sleeve across his cheek. "I might be. And what will you do about it without any of your Nazi friends to save you?"
"I'm entitled to a fresh start, just like you."
"I'm nothing like you." Livy grabs Magda's hand and drags her away.
"It's a big ship," he calls as they walk away. "Who would notice if a little mouse fell overboard?"
Magda turns round, drawing the butt of the gun out of her pocket. "And who would care if a big oaf like you got a bullet in the back of his head?" she snarls. The sisters walk away. When they are at a safe distance, Magda rounds on her sister. "Livy, tell me who he is. What was all that about?" Magda is scared by the look in her sister's eyes. "It's nothing, Magda. He's someone from the past," says Livy, trying to smile but failing.
"But who is he? You can guess, can't you? A dirty capo from the camps. A Jew, if you can believe it. But I don't want to talk about it. I want to forget he ever existed."
Livy walks off to join the girls on deck, leaving Magda to trail behind her. Livy feels light-headed as the scenes of Isaac's cruelty come back to her. Once more she is standing by the gates of Birkenau, watching an SS officer hand his baton to the greasy-haired capo, who proceeds to batter the bodies of prisoners returning to camp.
"I remember you, girlie. Isaac never forgets a face," he had told her,
and she knows now that she will never forget his. But what really appalls her, what has utterly stumped Livy, is the fact that he could have killed her just now, while she was too immobilized to move or to call for help. Is this her reality now? Must she carry this crippling fear into her new life? She may no longer be a prisoner, but will she ever be truly free? The sisters walk past a gaggle of girls, giggling and pointing at a group of boys who are preening at their attention. Seeing it, Livy feels like she's stepped back out of the camp and into daylight. "This is normal life," she reminds herself. "People flirt and gossip and do whatever the hell they feel like without being plagued by the dark shadows of Auschwitz every minute of the day. Isn't it enough that she has to dream about Birkenau every night?" During the day, she promises herself, "I will look to the light." "Look at those boys," mutters Magda. "Peacocks." Livy looks at the boys. They are smartly dressed, wearing better than most in their refugee cast-offs. The boys are eyeing the girls, grinning and waving, except for one man, who stands apart, leaning against the railings lining the deck. He's looking straight at Livy. She averts her eyes, suddenly self-conscious, and when she glances back, he's still watching. "Who are they?" Magda asks one of the giggling girls. "The Fly Boys," she tells Magda.
"The what?"
"Pilots, technicians, great husband material." The girl is still laughing at her last remark as the sisters walk away. For the next couple of days, Livy forces herself to join in with the others' merriment, but Magda senses her growing discomfort.
"I'm just feeling seasick," she says, or, "Magda, you're smothering me. I'm not the kitten any more."
Livy takes to sitting alone in the evenings, at the front of the ship, staring into the horizon for the first signs of Israel. She hasn't seen Isaac again, and hopes that she never will. But, if she does, this time she vows she will call to the others. She will tell them what he has done, and they will throw him overboard. Strangely, the thought of his body disappearing beneath the waves doesn't make her feel better. They pass through the Dardanelles Channel and into the Aegean. Livy's senses are overwhelmed by the colour of the sea, and overwhelmed again when they hit the Mediterranean, skirting the coastline of Turkey. Next stop, Haifa, she thinks, and it will all be behind her. Auschwitz, Isaac, the Death March, all of it. As the sun dips below the horizon on the fourth day, Magda joins Livy at the bow. "I can see why you like to sit here," she muses. "It's so peaceful. Maybe tomorrow you'll be the first to spot land." "I feel safe here, like nothing can harm me," Livy says. "Does that sound strange?" "A little. But you are safe now. We both are. Whoever that man was, Livy, you have to put him out of your mind. Once we land, you'll never see him again. Now, let's go and eat before it's all gone." Magda stands up and holds out a hand to her sister, who takes it. As they turn to head towards the dining room, they hear them before they see them. The Peacock Boys, as Magda has taken to calling them. They're talking loudly amongst themselves, but it's for the benefit of the girls who have gathered to watch this display. "Not this lot again," says Magda, loud enough to be heard by the boys and the girls. Livy's laughter dies in her throat when she sees him again, the lone flyboy, standing to one side, looking at her. Blushing, she grabs Magda's arm, and they run to dinner. In the late afternoon of the following day, the port of Haifa looms into view. The ship is instantly filled with cries of excitement and cheer. Feet pound the deck in a restless enthusiasm to set foot on dry land. And then the world tilts. Livy's screams pierce the air as a gun explodes. She is immediately on all fours, hunkering to the ground as the joyful cacophony continues around her. She runs her hands over her body. Has she been shot? Did he get her? "Livy? Livy, what's wrong?" Magda is kneeling beside her. "It's just some idiot firing his gun into the air to celebrate. Come on!" As Livy stumbles to her feet, the captain steps onto deck, and instantly the cheering stops. His face is red, and there is fury in his eyes as he raises a bullhorn to his mouth. "Who just fired a gun on my ship?" he roars. No one speaks, although the hands of all the men and women go to their pockets, feeling for their own guns. "I will not ask again," bellows the captain. "I will turn this damn ship around and take everyone back if you don't come forward right now." A hesitant hand is raised in the crowd. "I'm sorry, Captain." The culprit, a young man, continues. "I just got carried away. I won't do it again." "Come here," the captain orders, holding out his hand. "The gun, please." The man steps forward and places the weapon in the captain's hand. The captain pockets the gun and slaps the man hard across the head. He takes his punishment without a word. The crowd is more subdued after that, and Magda and Livy head for the bow of the ship, from where the port of Haifa is steadily growing in size. They are home.